On behalf of CHEST, I'd like to welcome you to March 2019 podcast. I am George Cheng from Duke University, sitting in for Dr. Kyle Hogarth. Thank you for joining us today for another terrific conversation. My first guest today is Dr. Neil Navani, Clinical Director for Lung Cancer and Interventional Bronchoscopy Services at University College London Hospital, London, UK, here to talk about his study, the accuracy of clinical staging of stage 1 to 3A non-small cell lung cancer, and analysis based on individual participant data. Neil, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
My next guest is Dr. Gerald Silvestri, the Hillenbrand Professor of Thoracic Oncology at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, South Carolina, here to talk about his accompanying editorial, Setting the Stage for Success in Lung Cancer, the Importance of Remembering Your Guidelines. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, without further ado for our listeners, we're going to launch right into this discussion. Neil, why don't you start us up and tell us what motivated you to do the study and what you did and why?
Thanks very much. We all know how important clinical staging of non-small cell lung cancer is. We use it every day in our clinical practice, and it helps to determine our conversations with our patients in the clinic. We talk about prognosis and treatment options with our patients based on a clinical stage. But what we're not clear about, perhaps, is the accuracy of that clinical staging that we have. So what we wanted to do with this study is really try and examine how accurate clinical staging is. So what we did for this study was to look at individual participant data from 9 randomized trials. We chose trials of neoadjuvant chemotherapy versus surgery alone. And we discarded the patients who had had neoadjuvant chemotherapy and just focused on the patients that had surgery alone. And in these clinical trials, therefore, we had very detailed and individual patient-level information on their clinical stage and their pathological stage. And I suppose one of the advantages of using this group of patients is that each one of those patients would have undergone protocolized clinical staging in a relatively expert center participating in these clinical trials. So we were then able to extract the clinical staging and compare that directly to the pathological staging. And I think perhaps some of the results that we got were slightly surprising. So we did find that overall about 48% of people, the pathological stage, disagreed with the clinical stage. And this is, as I say, from these 9 clinical trials, totaling about 700 patients. We found that...
I'm going to stop you right there, just to kind of break this down a little farther for our listeners. Neil, understanding so understanding the difference between clinical staging and pathological staging. Perhaps you can elaborate a little bit on that.
Of course. So clinical staging refers to all of the staging techniques and processes that occur before definitive treatment. Pathological staging refers to the results of the histological staging at the time of surgery. So there's a very big difference between the techniques that are employed. So clinical staging typically in modern thoracic oncology would involve whole body PET scanning, perhaps scanning of the brain, and very often, as I'm sure we'll touch on in more detail, invasive mediastinal staging, typically with endobronchial ultrasound, endoscopic ultrasound, or perhaps mediastinoscopy. So all of those investigations would be considered clinical staging, whereas pathological staging refers to the stage obtained at the time of thoracic surgery, which, according to current guidelines, would involve systematic ipsilateral lymph node dissection.
Okay. Gerald, can you comment, can you share your thoughts about how important this topic of staging and how that will actually affect our management for our patients?
Yeah, so for me, first of all, I just want to absolutely compliment Neil on the study. I was lucky enough to review it and then write the editorial. And it's just such a simple yet brilliantly designed study. And so, and it gives us incredible information, right? Like just taken off the top, half of the patients are under or over staged. Why is that important? If you look at the treatment options for lung cancer, they are so markedly different based on stage. And so, you know, stage one is generally, early stage one is generally resection. Stage two is resection followed by chemotherapy. Stage three is generally chemoradiotherapy plus or minus immunotherapy. Stage four is targeted therapy, immunotherapy, or classic chemotherapy or supportive care, depending on your performance status. And so you get that wrong, patients aren't going to do as well. And particularly the one I'm interested in the most and where I see real mix-ups in our cancer clinic and when we see patients for second opinion are people who are misstaged as stage three. For example, I'll give you a perfect example. They have a PET scan where they have mediastinal involvement on PET, but it's never followed up by invasive staging, and so they're deemed a stage three patient without ever having been sampled in the mediastinum, and those patients have been denied potentially of curative resection surgery. So it's absolutely imperative, not just for treatment options, for prognosis, so discussions with family, as Neil said, but there are two other reasons, too. It provides a common language for us to discuss cases with colleagues and other services. So the TNM system provides a common language. And lastly, it allows us to look in to enroll patients in clinical trials. And so what's so interesting about this study is these are clinical trials. And we still got it wrong with very detailed staging. Anyone who's enrolled in clinical trials knows how detailed that methodology is, which begs the question, how much, quote, worse could this be out in the community where you don't have the detailed staging requirements that you do for entrance into a clinical trial?
This is fascinating because I mean coming from all of us in the treatment of our patients, what we're seeing here is in Neil's study is that there's actually a significant difference between the clinical staging versus the pathological staging, and that translates to an inappropriate treatment options for our patients. I find that astonishing. But Neil, why don't you tell us a little bit more in detail about what you found?
Yeah, so thank you, Gerald, for very kind words. And as you've already said, almost half of the patients, the pathological stage, disagreed with the clinical stage. And when we break that down, the major misclassification happens in the nodal staging. So I think one of the really critical findings for, to my mind, is when we just look at clinical stage one disease. So currently, our treatment options are obviously surgery, but also there are other options such as stereotactic radiotherapy or even percutaneous ablative techniques. So if we were to try SABR or those ablative techniques, we wouldn't have pathological staging. But if we look just at that clinical stage one group, we find that about 10% in this study of patients actually had pathological stage 3A or higher. So I think that's a really important group of patients, because in those patients, just treating the stage one cancer would have essentially be a futile treatment if we were to miss metastatic disease in their mediastinum. The other, I think, really important clinical finding from the paper is that about almost 20% of patients who were clinically staged as N0 turned out to have nodal disease, either N1 or N2 or N3 nodal disease. And again, as Gerard has pointed out with our current treatment algorithms, that essentially implies that in up to 20% of patients, we are often getting potentially our treatment options wrong. In our clinics.
So, Neil, so, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Neil, I just want to go back and comment on the idea of what we do in clinical practice. I'm sure it's pretty similar on both sides of the pond. But, you know, for patients who are in inoperable stage one, we often refer to stereotactic body radiotherapy or SABR. What I am so interested in, and I'd like to hear from you, is that, yes, you know, at our tumor board sometimes we go, okay, well, should we do an endobronchial ultrasound to stage the mediastinum? I mean, remember, these patients are often on oxygen and not you know, for they're not getting operated on for a reason, right? And so sometimes we do stage them with a staging EBUS, and sometimes we don't. I think this paper really calls into question whether we shouldn't do that on everyone. You know, if it's if they're clinically stable enough to have a bronchoscopy, what would you agree with that? Would that be something that you think is?
I agree with you, Gerard. And as you say, it is a topic of debate in our sort of tumor board meetings as well. I think if the PET scan is negative and the tumor is really a T1A tumor, then perhaps. And there are no enlarged lymph nodes in the hilar or mediastinal regions, then perhaps it can be avoided. But I think invasive mediastinal staging, I think more often than not, I think is indicated in these patients prior to offering SABR or percutaneous ablation. In Europe, there has been a clinical trial running specifically addressing this. This question where patients have been randomized to either going ahead with the SABR or percutaneous ablation versus having invasive mediastinal staging with EBUS and in the US prior to SABR. So, and that should report, I believe, at the end of this year.
Really interesting findings, and can you, Neil, can you tell us a little about this the incorrect staging and how it affected the treatment for these patients, and which patient population actually did worse? Is it the understaged ones or the overstaged ones?
Well, certainly in our paper, the major problem was understaging, and I think both understaging and overstaging will have profound effects on patient options and patient choices. So I think understaging, clearly we may miss mediastinal disease, and actually that means that we would not be having conversations with patients about options of chemoradiotherapy and subsequently immunotherapy, and maybe our focus would just be on surgery when in fact discussion with the patient should be focused around chemotherapy and radiotherapy. So I think that's the main issue, I suspect, with understaging. But then overstaging as well worries me enormously. If, as in the example that Gerard brought up earlier, if we assume that there are nodal metastases and we think that there is a disease in the mediastinal lymph node, that may inappropriately preclude a patient from being offered potentially curative surgery. So I think both understaging and overstaging are really important when we're coming to offer treatment options to our patient. And as I say, it's almost the overstaging, which was slightly less frequent in this paper than the understaging, but it was the overstaging that worries me perhaps even more. There is an argument, particularly on this side of the pond, perhaps more than in the US currently, that understaging may not be as much of an issue as we think, as long as surgery is included as part of the multimodality treatment. So that even if we were to miss small volume metastases in the mediastinum, as long as surgery followed by adjuvant treatments is offered, that may not necessarily affect patient outcomes.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Neil. I would say, and you know, it's a question I had written down. I was going to ask you. I don't think either of us know the answer to this. But even with the best of staging, I feel like, what number could we get that's better than a 50% misclassification? You know, I think if we can get it down to less than 10%, we're never going to get to zero, because what we are going to always find is you could do the best EVIS, you could do the best mediastinoscopy, but there could be micrometastatic disease, which should get resected at the time of surgery. And by the way, those patients have a better outcome post-adjuvant chemotherapy. So I don't want to be too hard on us. I was wondering what you thought in terms of that 48% of cases misclassified. I mean, I don't know that either of us know the answer within that trial, but I would guess that some of that, there was no way anyone was going to get right.
No, I think that's fair. In terms of, trying to get that number down as low as possible, I think we should strive to get it down as low, purely because of the putting the treatment options to the patient. Because if I don't think we should stop striving for the higher sensitivity that we can reach. But I entirely agree that figure of sort of understaging is never going to be 0%. We will always be limited by the sensitivities of the techniques that we use. And even in the very best hands, EBUS and EBUS and US combined are still not going to have a sensitivity of 100%, as you say. There is a study that you may be familiar with called the SCORE study by European colleagues, Professor Anema and colleagues, that has specifically looked at very detailed, systematic, invasive staging of all lymph nodes within the mediastinum greater than 8 millimeters, regardless of PET avidity, via routine EBUS and EUS. And that study suggested that there was a 10% superior sensitivity of nodal detection by that systematic approach over approach simply by sampling the enlarged or avid or FDG avid lymph nodes. So that potentially is an area, I think, where we could strive to get that inaccuracy down even further if we were to adopt that routinely. But I do agree that figure of inaccuracy is never going to be zero.
Yeah, and I would say, Neil, while I agree with that and I've read that study, I just want people to even stage the mediastinum at all. Let's start there, where folks aren't even doing invasive staging at all. That would probably cut out 25 or 30% of the inaccuracy right there. And in fact, in the States, Peter Mazzone wrote about this a while back, where we got together and we talked about what would be good, what we call in the United States, quality indicators. Just like, for example, do elderly patients in a primary care practice get the flu shot? Do patients after an MI get a beta blocker? What would be a good quality indicator? And interestingly, one of the ones that percolated to the top almost immediately in lung cancer was accurate staging in the mediastinum. And so, I definitely think, sort of quality improvement endeavors could help us to get that number down. And still, I don't think we'd get it down to zero. But we could do better for sure.
So for the listeners and for myself, to just kind of summarize what we're discussing here, one is to actually stage the mediastinum accurately by having potentially quality measures even with a PET, suppose a patient with PET positive mediastinum, that patient should be staged and to get actual tissue sample from the lymph nodes. That's one quality measure. And number two, even for patients with a PET negative mediastinum, is perhaps the question that we're really trying to address is those patients should also be staged systematically to further reduce the chance of this discrepancy of incorrect staging or understaging or overstaging our patients and therefore not getting them the right treatment they have. Is that correct? Would you guys say that's one of the goals?
Absolutely. And in fact, in the 2013 CHEST guidelines on staging, which I was the lead author for, that's exactly what we recommend. The only case we don't recommend that, I think Neil has already pointed out. So we recommend for central tumors, for tumors greater than 3 centimeters, irrespective of the mediastinum, we want those patients staged with generally a needle technique first. The one place where I think there's been controversy and we have low-level evidence is for a peripheral stage 1A tumor with a negative CT of the mediastinum and a negative PET of the mediastinum, those patients could go directly to surgery. The level of evidence was poor, but that was what the consensus from the guideline panel recommended. So that'd be the only time we would say you don't do invasive mediastinal staging prior to treatment. Is that how you follow in England, Neil?
Something very similar, but we have a more sort of inclusive role for PET, I think, where even in the stage one cases, we would still preoperatively offer a PET CT and then sample any FDG avid areas within the mediastinum or elsewhere prior to surgery. So I think the difference there perhaps is just in the very small primary tumors.
Still
carry out a PET CT.
Yeah, no, Neil, maybe you mistook what I said, or I didn't say it well, which is probably the latter. We do PET CT on those stage 1As and then follow it up if any PET in the mediastinum is avid. And also for PET, the reason we do PET CT prior to surgery is that, you know, there's that 10% risk of finding undetected metastatic disease. So we do definitely do PET in those patients. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same, similar here. So now I actually found this portion of the finding in your study, Neil, very fascinating in the sense that this clinical study, the clinical staging and the pathological staging, the discrepancy was not associated with age, gender, histology, or staging method or years of randomization with all the RCTs that you looked at. Can you tell us a little bit more about what do you see as this discrepancy? Meaning, what factors do you think is actually affecting this? Besides the fact that maybe we're not staging appropriately, we're not doing the appropriate staging in the beginning.
Sure. So, I mean, we looked at several of these factors really to try and identify whether any of them would predict inaccurate staging. And again, we're a little surprised to find that particularly the year of randomization, the staging methods that we used, and perhaps even the histology did not affect the accuracy of staging. There may be some evidence to suggest, for example, that adenocarcinomas are more likely to miss mediastinal metastases than perhaps in those with squamous cell carcinomas, but that was not borne out in this data. And then similarly, something that we did expect to see was that with more modern staging techniques, that the accuracy would improve. Now, I think it's a limitation of our study that many of the patients were recruited some time ago, and these and the staging algorithms perhaps don't match the quality of staging algorithms that we have currently. But a lot of the patients in the trial actually had invasive mediastinal staging with mediastinoscopy, whereas it's fair to say that many did not have a PET scan. So despite adjusting for, when we looked at particularly the association with the type of staging technique and the year of the randomization that the patient was enrolled, there didn't seem to be any significant difference in the accuracy. And then perhaps even more interesting, if we look at some of the other data that's around, not from randomized trials as we've done here, but from registry data that is held in various countries, and the Dutch lung cancer registry has published not so long ago similar data comparing the clinical to pathological staging, and to our surprise found something very similar. in terms of the level of inaccuracy, and that's despite routine use of PET CT and modern invasive techniques.
You know, one thing that kind of jumped out at this to me was I was wondering, when comparing the initial clinical staging to the actual pathological staging, the time lapse between the two. Was there any data that's available to assess? So, for instance, a patient coming with a PET CT scan had clinical staging performed, and then, but unfortunately, was not able to schedule the surgery for until a month or 2 months later. How would that affect the pathological staging? Is there any data on that realm?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, actually. And I think particularly in the UK, where suddenly woken up, I think, to the fact that time does matter to patients undergoing surgery. Unfortunately, with our study, we didn't have data on the gap between the final clinical staging and the time of surgery, so we're unable to answer that question. But I am aware of a study published very recently in CHEST that looks specifically at time to surgery from diagnosis and showed a direct correlation between worse outcomes and longer time to surgery. So I think that's something that is also of real significance. So not only does accurate staging matters, but perhaps related speed as well of getting our patients through to treatment also matters.
Gerald, can you comment about how we can sort of systematically approach this in a system-wide fashion, or how do you do it in your institution to ensure this this shorten the time frame between the clinical staging and the pathological staging, or together the treatment?
Absolutely. Before I do that, I do want to go over one thing that we talked about in terms of the no difference in random, date of the trials, no difference in gender, no difference in histology. The one that was really interesting to me, Neil, was the no difference in age. I feel like people get a bit lazier in terms of their staging as patients get older. They just don't want to put them through the testing. And so I would just alert our audience that, you know what? If we're going to put patients through a major operation in their elderly years, we should do accurate staging. So my heart was a little bit warmed by the fact that, at least in this study, now these were randomized trials, so to get in the study, they had to do certain things, but at least in this study, it didn't make a difference in terms of the accuracy of staging based upon age. So I just want to throw that in as one comment. Regarding your question about what do we do here, what do we hold as a standard? So I work in a multidisciplinary clinic. So every Tuesday I have two thoracic surgeons, two pulmonologists, two medical oncologists, and one radiotherapist in 20 rooms right around each other. We have a rule that we get any new patient referred in with a new lung mass to our clinic in 10 working days, which is 2 weeks. They generally come to the pulmonologist first for diagnosis and staging. And we try to, from the time we see them, which is within that two-week time frame, if they're surgical candidates, we try to get them into the operating room within 2 weeks of them hitting the door for us. And so I think part of this is the multidisciplinary approach allows for a much decreased time frame in terms of getting patients to the operating room. The second thing is, and this is such an interesting thing that we have looked at in terms of quality improvement in our clinic, which is what holds people up, generally what holds people up. And I know this is a problem in Europe, and when I visited there a while back, Neil, it was a problem, particularly in the UK, of getting people to PET scan, for example, or getting people's PFTs done or a blood gas done. And so what we really tried to do is break down those barriers in getting that extra testing done getting them treated. So what we found out was, hey, you know what? The PET scanner was willing to open up slots in the evening hours for us, so at 10 o'clock at night. And patients are more than happy to come and get that PET scan at 10 o'clock at night if it means that they get their treatment started sooner. I would say to the audience listening that, they've looked at psychological studies of cancer patients about what is the sort of most stressful time in the trajectory of cancer. You would think that most stressful time would be right before the patient dies, but that's actually not true. The most stressful time for a patient has been when they are being told they might have cancer and the first treatment. And so shortening that time not only helps get them the best care that they can get, it also really relieves a lot of stress on patients. And anybody who does mostly cancer for a living, like the three of us on this call, we understand that. And so I think trying to do some quality improvement measures in your own institution to take the barriers out, generally they're testing barriers, getting patients to a multidisciplinary tumor board in a timely fashion. Those things can be overcome very quickly if you have teamwork and a reasonable hospital administration willing to listen.
Neil, any comments on how your institution is approaching this matter of shortening the time between diagnosis and treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to echo everything that Gerard said. I think working together as a team is really important here. And I think it's not just the sort of the senior clinicians who are patient-facing, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done by the administrative team, by the booking teams. And as Gerard says, it's a very stressful time for patients. And quite often we put them through a tremendous amount in often a very short period of time. So a PET scan, an EBUS, lung function. We want them to have a CPEX test. We may want them to have an MRI scan of their brain. These are a lot of investigations to put someone through as we've said, an extremely stressful time. So it does require a multidisciplinary approach. One thing that we, I think, are pretty strong on in the UK is having nurse navigators who sort of meet the patient right at the beginning of their pathway and then help them through all of the investigations and right through to initial treatment and beyond. And we really find that they are a really crucial part of the lung cancer team that can really help to improve the patient experience and smooth their way through the pathway and sort of help that whole process through to the first treatment.
Neil, could I ask a quick question of you? I'm familiar with Lusarda and Mick Peek, who's a brilliant epidemiologist and has worked around the country tying together your databases. Do you see big differences between, you know, you're at UCLH, it's a London-based hospital, a lot of super subspecialists. Over the last 10 years or so, have we seen the wait times, for example, go down in surgery, the wait times from the time a chest x-ray is done or a CT he's done to that shows a nodule or a mass to getting in the clinic and any differences between rural, urban, or underserved communities?
Thanks, Gerard. So as you say, Professor Peake set up a long time ago a national lung cancer audit. Myself and two colleagues have taken that on in the last couple of years as well, and we now collect data on a huge variety of markers of lung cancer care, including, as you say, parts of what we call the cancer waiting times. Now, the times to treatment have traditionally been in the UK stuck at 62 days. So from time, what you just described earlier as time from an initial consultation through to surgery or whatever the first treatment may be, the mandated maximum timescale there is 62 days. Just recently, in the last year or so, we've mandated that to come down to about 49 days. And I have to say, what on the surface is, you know, a relatively small reduction in a patient pathway has proved quite challenging from a resource perspective in the UK. And as you say, it puts extra strain on PET scanner resources and obviously EBUS and lung function laboratories. So there is a tremendous amount of work and a tremendous amount of willing from the lung cancer community to deliver this. I think one of the problems is we need to probably shout louder for resources and really sort of make sure that our patients are not being shortchanged and really try and get them through their lung cancer pathway as quickly and as smoothly as possible.
Yeah, I think that's getting the patient through the pathway can even translate to survival benefits, as your study have shown in this case, or suggest in this case. It seems like this is the first time that your study have demonstrated the impact in accuracy clinical staging on patient survival outcomes. So this is really really important kind of beaconing light for us to actually follow, because this is really bring everything to the forefront of consideration. How do we formulate a systematic approach to not only for staging but to optimize patient management and care going forward? Now there's a few in the field of bronchoscopy. Recently, there's been an effort to provide both the staging and potential treatment options that ranges from staging and then resection of a peripheral nodule in the same setting, or staging and potentially even ablation of the same nodule of the pulmonary nodules in the same setting, potentially for that are diagnostic for malignancy. I wonder what the implications for these type of approaches are. Gerald or Neil, why do you kind of take this up?
Neil, you want to go first?
I think this is another really exciting area. With bronchoscopy, we would have the potential to provide detailed staging information. As you say, provide nodal staging information, and then using peripheral bronchoscopy techniques such as navigational bronchoscopy, radial EBUS, and so on, we will be able to sample the primary lesion so we get a full picture of the intrathoracic disease. And then depending on what we find, in an isolated primary lesion, we may, as you say, be able to offer bronchoscopic guided ablation. I personally have not done a bronchoscopic ablation yet. I don't know whether you have, Gerard, but one of my colleagues in London has done a few now, and it certainly seems to be a very exciting area.
So let me take a little bit of an alternative approach here, and I'm writing about this, and I think it might challenge the pulmonary community in ways they haven't felt challenged before. I think we've oversold a couple things. One is I think we've oversold the diagnostic yield of bronchoscopy, particularly in the periphery. And by the way, I was going to mention that about this study, Neil, which is, people were doing mediastinoscopies in the study and EBUS and other things, and they were just missing it, right? And so in our staging guideline, EBUS had a sensitivity of 89%. So why is the only, if we have good people doing EBUS, why is the inaccuracy at 50%? And it may be a lot of things, but one of the things is maybe the technology is not as good as we think it is. So I've come down to sort of three things: technique, technology, or patient selection. And so when it comes to technique, it's one thing to have the greatest bronchoscopists in the world, the Neil Novanis, the Felix Hirths, Kazu Yasufuku, doing these types of procedures. And then when they publish 100 cases, their yield is very high on the diagnostic side. Those 100 cases, and they're sometimes retrospective, single site, high volume centers with incredible support systems, they get collected together and put into what we call meta-analysis, and I'm as guilty because we published the meta-analysis on peripheral bronchoscopy. And so what you end up doing is putting these things together in a fashion, and then people start to believe that. What we've seen recently, though, is that the diagnostic yield, particularly of peripheral bronchoscopy, may be just better than 50%. And so I would urge us to to really be, I don't think you're being dishonest, Neil, but the pulmonary community in general has to be a bit more honest about its diagnostic yields. And then that leads me to the therapeutics. While it's absolutely exciting, and we're doing things with robotic bronchoscopy, we're doing things with, electromagnetic navigation, and then we get out there, let's remember when we get out there, the reason to do a diagnostic and treatment setting would be, first of all, in patients who couldn't be resected surgically, because those patients deserve to have curative intent. So let's now move on to the patients who are non-surgical candidates and say, okay, well, what about a one-stop shop where we would do a diagnostic and in the lab have on-site cytopathology, and now we're going to do a therapeutic? Well, that therapeutic better be as good or better than, or at least as good as, stereotactic body radiotherapy, because that's an incredibly safe procedure, 2 to 3 treatments, 3 to 4 treatments, depending on where you are, as an outpatient, incredibly well tolerated with a 90%+ local control rate at 3 years. So while I am excited about the technology, while I believe that there is someday could be a place for that, right now, man, I think just getting overly excited about it is problematic, because we still have a ways to go, even on the diagnostic side, to get this right. So I know that rains a little bit on the interventional pulmonary parade, but I just think we need to be a bit more tough on our own technology. We have very few randomized trials. We just published a trial in chest where we did regular transbronchial with fluoroscopy in 1 to 5 centimeter lesions versus peripheral ebus, and the yield was something like 47% with peripheral ebus and 37%. And this was 4 centers in the United States, Hopkins, WashU, us, University of Florida. So good centers, and we still weren't had a diagnostic yield that I think is reasonable. So I would say that I'm a bit more skeptical. I'll leave it at that.
Jared, I entirely take your point. It's very well taken. I think patient selection, I think, here is absolutely crucial. And I think those patients who are operable, you're absolutely right, they should have surgery. Those patients who are suitable for Sabre should absolutely have Sabre, in my view. I think there is still, and there are other patients who would benefit from this, from a bronchoscopic approach. So in particular, those that are in what we term as the no-fly zone for Sabre, so within 2 right. centimeters of a main bronchus. And actually, as it happens, that's perhaps quite a convenient area for us to approach bronchoscopically right. as well, as it's a little bit more proximal. So that's a group of patients that I think for whom treatment options previously have been a little bit more tricky. The second group are those that have very poor lung function and those that have pulmonary fibrosis. So there's strong data to suggest that Sabre should not perhaps be used routinely in people with evidence of significant pulmonary fibrosis mm-hmm. on their CT scan. And clearly they're a group that are at higher risk of lung cancer. So in those, I entirely take your point about the, I think there's work to be done with the technology. But I think there is still patient selection is important here. And I still think that there is a group of people who in just a primary lung cancer in those particular scenarios would benefit from a bronchoscopic approach.
I completely agree. I'll add another.
Need to do better.
Yeah, I'll add another group to your group, which is people who have been previously irradiated that you can't, go back and radiate.
Yeah.
Local recurrence. So I don't disagree with it. And I think it's exciting, and I want us to do it. I just want to force our field to do better studies, to do what I refer to as technology assessment in a sound way before the technology rolls out and people start using it without having data to support it.
Totally agree.
Yeah, agreed. I couldn't agree more. Neil and Gerald, again, this is truly a fantastic conversation, really fascinating in terms of going from diagnosis to streamlining management to what the future potentially holds for the entire field. But unfortunately, we're close to out of time. So let's wrap up. Neil, what do you want our listeners to take away from your study?
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure to be on this podcast. What I want people to take away, think very carefully about the clinical staging. Follow your guidelines absolutely as closely as possible, and really think about invasive mediastinal staging if that nodal status affects the treatment for our patient.
Gerald, final comments?
I would agree to everything Neil said. I would add one other thing, which is we should not care which technology we use to make the stage most accurate. So, for example, if you don't have great EBUS support, or if you feel uncomfortable that this wouldn't be the easiest EBUS, please go ahead and use mediastinoscopy or a VATS approach to a left-sided AP window lymph node where EBUS is not going to get it. I don't think we need to concern ourselves with which technology we use. Just get the invasive staging done in the mediastinum, which is really the critical part of staging for lung cancer. The metastatic disease will take care of itself, but I think the mediastinum is an area we could do a lot better. And it doesn't matter which technology you use, just use the one that has most chance to get a diagnosis.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Navani and Dr. Severelstri, for your time and the exciting discussion. And for our listeners, you will find this article and more in the Trias Journal. I hope you enjoyed this conversation, and we look forward to be with you here next time. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.